This is the Patriots All 22 podcast on the CLNS Media Network, the leading online provider for the six-time Super Bowl champion New England Patriots.
Welcome into a new edition of the Patriots All 22 podcast, powered by the CLNS Media Podcast Network. I am Evan Lazar, joined as always by Adam Kirchen, and we are recording this on Thursday night, a couple of days here before Patriots minicamp opens up on June 4th through the 6th, Tuesday through Thursday of next week. Those listening to it this week, a lot to talk about, I think, with this mini camp. One of the more competitive rosters. We've been talking about it pretty much since the draft, Adam, just how competitive they are top to bottom, 1 through 90. There's going to be a lot of difficult cuts here over the next couple of months for this team.
Yeah. Like we were talking about last time, it's a pretty deep roster. You know, it's not top heavy.
No.
So, you know, after the draft, I mean, we liked a lot of the guys in the draft. We expect some of those guys to really, you know, make impacts and probably push some guys off the team. And so I think it's going to be really competitive. I think a lot of the guys that were already on the team are sort of feeling it a little bit more, especially after this draft. And we'll get into that. But, you know, I think it'll be good. Like, I mean, this is what you want. You know, you want a camp that's competitive. You want guys who are fighting for their jobs. It just makes everybody better.
Yeah, and obviously this mini camp is mandatory, so Tom Brady will be out there. All 90 guys on the roster will be out there. And I think that's going to be, you know, really interesting to see, as well as kind of just how this whole thing looks with everybody out there, how Tom Brady looks throwing the ball to N'Keal Harry. Obviously, is going to be a big storyline. Ryan Allen versus Jake Bailey, which we'll get to in a little bit here, also going to be a big storyline. But what we're going to do to kind of preview minicamp with you guys is we're going to come out with five burning questions ahead of Pat's minicamp from all different, you know, angles here at the roster. But the one that I wanted to start with, which I think is kind of one that's on most people's minds, is who has the most to prove in this camp? Because we just said it, it's a very competitive roster, and I think that there's going to be some surprise cuts, maybe not the veteran guys that you're, you know, kind of expecting to make it, but some of these first and second year players could be on the outside looking in. Who do you have as kind of the prove it camp, the guy that needs a big camp here this summer?
I think it's Duke Dawson for me.
Yeah.
It's obviously a guy we were pretty critical of when they picked him last year. You know, was either injured or a healthy scratch last year, and just didn't really get on the field. So, you know, they drafted, they had corners pass them up last year, and then they drafted Juwan Williams.
Yeah.
You know, how many guys are they going to keep for that position? Do they have a specialized role for him? I think, you know, if you're looking at the numbers, you really have a hard time getting him on the team, you know, especially with some of the guys that are already there and that they brought in. You know, I don't really see a place for him on the field yet, but, you know, maybe he has a much better camp. Maybe he grasps the system a little better. You know, there's always something that can spark a player in year two, but, you know, I think he really has to prove that, you know, he's worthy of, you know, being on the field because he didn't do it the first year.
Yeah. They tend to have long leashes with those guys that were, you know, high priority picks, guys that they've invested heavy in the draft, in guys like Jordan Richards or Cyrus Jones come to mind, you know, as bad examples of that. But also at times they've had guys that they've kind of waited it out with them for a couple of years and they end up turning it around or figuring it out in year two or three or something like that. So I think it works both ways. But point being that for a guy like Duke Dawson, I think everybody's kind of thought about him as like kind of having a specialized role, like you said, more like a Patrick Chung type player or something like that, who's kind of a safety corner hybrid, playing in the box, covering tight ends, maybe covering the slot. He was a pure slot receiver at Florida, or slot corner at Florida. That's all he did, was play slot corner. And we both didn't really love the pick at the time. I think, you know, I said this to you when we were, you know, talking about what we were going to talk about today, and I just hope that they don't kind of give him too long of a leash, right? Like, if you realize that you've made a mistake with this pick, let's not have another Jordan Richards situation where he's still costing the team games because they whiffed on a guy in the second round, you know, 2 to 3 years later. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think it's really interesting about him because I think that there is a potential, too, that one of these corners ends up becoming trade bait for another team that
right.
to fill a role of another team. Maybe there's a team out there that really liked Duke Dawson in the draft and wants to give him a shot. I think the point that you brought up that other players have passed him on the roster or on the depth chart is a really good one. I mean, J.C. Jackson was an undrafted rookie last year, and Duke Dawson, he left Duke Dawson in the dust. Right. I mean, even at training camp, even before Duke Dawson had that hamstring injury that ended with his season on IR, and then Duke Dawson came back and he still couldn't beat out J.C. Jackson in practice to get on the field later in the season. So J.C., a guy that obviously has a ton of talent and went undrafted for reasons that, you know, weren't necessarily football related. He just completely blew the doors off in that competition versus Duke. So I think it's very interesting to see what happens with Dawson. The guy that I wrote down, you know, along with Dawson, I agree with that one, is Braxton Berrios. In a kind of a similar boat, they've kind of gone away from the typical Patriots receiver with the small slot guys, but they still have Berrios kind of, you know, waiting in the wings a little bit here and as like kind of the last man standing along with Julian Edelman for that type of receiver. But last year in training camp, I was not overly impressed with Berrios. I didn't think that he really got open very easily or created a ton of separation, which is, I think, something that I thought he might be able to do, especially on those underneath routes like he did in college. And, you know, he ended up on IR, but I really think that that was their way of kind of not having to cut him and have him hit the waiver wire, because I think they were worried that they were going to lose him. So they ended up being able to sneak him on IR. But I think that with the way the depth chart looks, they've added a ton of talent at wide receiver. They've added, you know, a first-round pick. They've added veterans and guys like Inman and Demaryius Thomas. It's kind of an uphill battle for Berrios, I think, right now, who's going to have to make the roster as that backup slot receiver slash punt returner to Julian Edelman. That's really the only way for him on the roster right now.
Yeah, I agree. And it goes back to that point that we keep making is the depth here. You know, they've got a solid depth chart at wide receiver now.
Yeah.
With what they picked up in the offseason. And so it is a specialized role for Berrios because he's not an outside guy. He's not an elite separator, like you said. He's just somebody like in college, just going based off college, because, you know, I didn't have too much a chance to see him last year. So, you know, like going based off what he was in college is like, he was just sort of a big time, like, third down red zone yes. type guy, like dependable, a lot of the same type of things that you get out of like an Amendola.
Yeah.
So like if you have like a specialized role for him, he can be effective. I don't think he's somebody that's gonna this year, you know, break out or anything, but like, you know, if he makes the roster, it'll be as somebody who could, you know, come in if Edelman gets injured or something like that, because, you know, they don't really have too many guys like that currently on the roster. So that would be his role. But like you said, it's a pretty stacked position. And I think, you know, in general, that group is going to be interesting to watch.
I think that's a great point that he is almost like we've grown to accustomed to thinking that Berrios is the norm here in New England, but he's actually now kind of different from everybody else that they have a little bit. And, you know, maybe that is a part of it that helps him on the roster, is the fact that he is different from guys like Inman and N'Keal Harry and Demaryius and Josh Gordon and all these huge receivers. They really, I think a lot of people were hoping that Berrios was going to be like the future Edelman, right? Like the yeah. guy that took over that yeah. role from him. And he's still the only guy on the roster right now that fits that bill. They didn't draft anybody like that. They didn't sign any undrafted rookies or free agents like that. They didn't end up getting a guy like an Adam Humphries or a Cole Beasley. So that's kind of the guy, right, is Berrios right now. And this is kind of a make-or-break camp for him, I think. If he takes that role by storm, I think that he might, you know, have a chance to make this roster as kind of the next guy in waiting. Also, potentially, he's a very good punt returner in college.
Yes.
So maybe potentially as a guy that can kind of lessen the workload for Edelman by returning some of those punts, especially during the regular season. They've tried to get that guy in here for a while now, guys like Cyrus Jones, for example, to take away those punt returning duties from Edelman. They like don't want Edelman to return punts during the regular season if they can avoid it. But it feels like every single time he has to, because the guy just doesn't take the job, you know? And I think that that's a good way for Berrios to stay. I just think that, you know, at some point in time, these other guys, especially the veterans that they've brought in, obviously along with N'Keal Harry, who's a lock on the team, are just better players right now than Berrios. So it's a question of, are you going to take the future or are you going to take the present? And I think that more times than not in recent years, the Patriots have kind of picked the present in that discussion. All right, let's move on to the next question here. What's the best position battle? I think there's a ton of great position battles in this camp, and it's kind of hard to narrow it down to one, but we'll each give one. What do you got?
Well, the one that I really want to see the most is at tight end.
Yeah.
I just want to see somebody emerge.
Oh, God,
You know what I mean? I just feel like it's one of those positions where you don't – I mean, obviously it's a huge hole with Gronkowski. Nobody's going to replace him, you know. But you want to see somebody who can, you know, be on the field at all times with that combination of blocking and receiving. And, you're going to see a major drop off no matter who gets it,
yeah.
But you want to see somebody like grab the reins a little bit. So, we'll see. I mean, I'd like to see somebody like Safarian Jenkins sort of take it, because, you know, he's younger than some of the other guys, but you know, I don't know. I'd love to see what Izzo does, what he brings to the table. I liked his college tape. I didn't think he was like a superstar or anything like that, but I thought he was a pretty good blocker and he showed pretty nice hands. So, it could be one of those deals where nobody really separates too much, and that's kind of what I'm expecting. But I'd like to see somebody like flash.
And that's what
I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing too that, you know, we all talk about what it's going to mean to the passing game and how they're going to score points without Gronkowski. What it means to the running game is almost just as important.
Right.
I mean, they not only lost Gronkowski, but they also lost Dwayne Allen. So they lost a ton of blocking out of that position too, like high level, you know, top tier blocking from those two guys. That's a lot to replace in the running game too. It's just a position, I think, that in the Patriots offense, for a long time now, especially since Gronkowski has been around, obviously, they ask a ton out of that position. They ask you to block. They ask you to run routes from different alignments. They ask you to be a vocal point in the offense. And that is a lot to ask of a guy like a Ryan Izzo or even a Matt Lacoste, who hasn't really done all of that. So I think what they've done, and I think the goal is that they kind of have a guy for each role, right? And,
yeah.
And it's going to be kind of, you know, predictable at times, I think, of who's on the field. And, you know, if it's a Ryan Izzo or even a guy like Safarian Jenkins, who's been a pretty solid blocker here later on in his career, they might be more of a run-heavy team with those guys. But when a guy like Ben Watson or Matt Lacoste or even Steven Anderson, who I think was in the mix a little bit at OTAs, what we saw last week, those guys all, you know, are at the same time a little bit more receiving threats. So maybe they're going to pass a little bit more. I think that it's going to be a very, you know, heavy tell maybe early on in the season until somebody really takes that job and is able to be that two-way threat. The guy, I mentioned Steven Anderson, I was pretty surprised he was really in the mix at camp last week. Now, at the same time, Safarian Jenkins isn't practicing right now. He wasn't at OTAs. I'm assuming he'll be at minicamp because it's mandatory. So we'll see what happens once he gets in the building and how that, kind of knocks Steven Anderson down. But Steven Anderson was getting in there with the ones and kind of mixing it up, especially playing a little bit more in the slot as like kind of a slot tight end versus playing in line. Mm-hmm. And Matt Lacoste was, you know, another guy who I think is on this roster. Like, I think that Matt Lacoste is going to be on the team based off of his contract. He looks comfortable out there running routes. You know, he's big, he's fast, he's got good hands. He just didn't really do much of as a blocker in Denver. He really didn't do much of at all in Denver. Yeah. But he's certainly a guy I think that they could like kind of surprise some people with, you know, and maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe it doesn't work out. But if it does work out, I could see us saying, you know, it being like a Monday Night Football telecast and the guys being like, well, who the hell is this Matt Lacoste guy? You know,
right.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And like all the everybody nationally has no idea who he is. And he has one of those big breakout games. I could see it happening for him, because when you watch them in these passing camps and there's no contact, the one thing that you want to watch stand out is like who pops with their speed, right? Whose athleticism just like shows up when you watch them. And Lacoste was one of those guys that was running pretty well and seemed like he could get up the seam and do some of the things that they want their tight ends to do. So I would say that those three guys, Seferian, Jenkins, Watson, and Lacoste, really have the inside track as kind of the three guys that are going to make the roster. But I also think that that leaves them pretty thin as in terms of a blocking tight end, unless Seferian Jenkins can really do that. So it also helps that you have James Devlin, you know, that they're kind of a different team in that respect, that they carry a fullback. So that definitely helps with some of the blocking. But maybe they go tackle eligible and they use more offensive lineman looks. I don't know, but losing a guy like Gronkowski and Dwayne Allen is like losing a sixth offensive lineman in some of these run sets.
100%. So
it's going to be interesting to see where they go with that. Speaking of the offensive line, the next question here is who plays left tackle? This one I think is kind of a flowing, you know, open-ended question that's probably going to lead up all the way to week one, depending on what happens with Isaiah Wynn. I would not expect to see Isaiah Wynn out there next week, but I would expect to see Yanni Kajust out there. His recovery timetable was a little bit shorter from his quad surgery, I believe it was, in the offseason. So it looks to me like next week at minicamp is either going to be Kajust or Joe Tooney, who was lining up there during OTAs last week.
Yeah, I, you know, obviously Tooney was lining up there, but I just want to see Kajust get as many reps as possible at that position. I think, you know, obviously somebody we both really liked in the draft. I think he's somebody that you just want to bring along, you know? And I think, if you have Tooney there in camp and everything like that, it's not the worst thing in the world. Like you mentioned, he played there in college, and Ted Karras is a good guard, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a pretty good, you know, guy off the bench. But I just want to see, Kajusti get as many reps as possible. I think, you know, down the line, he's somebody that is going to be on the team, as far as, you know, on the field and everything like that. I don't know where they want him as far as right or left side, but I just want to see Yadni get as many reps as possible. I think, you know, it's just critical to his development that he gets as many snaps as he can. And, you know, I think if they throw Tooney out there, that's fine. But I think, you know, this is another one of those deals too, where at this time of year, they try as many combinations as possible. And it's more about just like, I don't know. It's more about seeing what everybody can do. And I want to see what Yadni can do.
Yeah. I think the good thing is that if they do have to go with Tooney, I don't think that Tooney being at left tackle is their best combination on paper, right? Like obviously you'd rather have him play left guard, but they do have Karras. And see, they seem to like Brian Schwanke a whole lot, who was on the roster for most of the season last year. And they also drafted my guy Yelda Froholt, who is a really good left guard in college in the SEC at Arkansas. So those are three, I think, viable NFL caliber interior offensive linemen if they have to go that route with Tooney at left tackle. But I think the thing about Kajust getting his reps is he's pretty relatively new to football. He's not a guy that's played, not like a football lifer that's played football his entire career or his entire life. He, I think, started maybe late in high school, like something like his junior or senior year of high school.
Right.
And then when he got to West Virginia, he was hurt a little bit as well at West Virginia. So he didn't play every single game there either. So there's a lot of kind of developing there. I think a lot of people that you talk to about him say the sky's the limit based off of the traits, right? If you can keep him on the field, and you can get that kind of refinement going on with some of the things that he's got to do, he's got a really nice skill set, like nice feet, really heavy upper body. When we saw the kind of watching him before the draft, some of the hand usage that he can do, you know, throw a lot of heavy hands at people. All that stuff is great. So I think that he has a chance to start at left tackle. I mean, he started left tackle for a very good offense in college football. And I think the main thing, though, is that he is still a little bit raw, you know, just in terms of not being a football lifer. And secondly, that West Virginia offense, the way that they ask their linemen, especially their tackles, to set the splits that they use, and also the depth in their pass sets, is completely different than what he's going to have
right
in the NFL. Like, you're only setting, like, you know, maybe one or two steps off the line of scrimmage in that kind of offense, and you're not setting for a very long time either, because the ball's coming out so quickly in a lot of those, like, kind of designed, you know, quick out type plays. So that is a big difference. I don't know how much of a big difference the Scardecchia would necessarily say it is, but I think it is. And, you know, I think you kind of have to learn from it and go from there if you're Kajus. So I would love to see him get in there. I think their best possible offensive line is keeping Tooney, Andrews, and Mason exactly where they are. Like, that's, you know, kind of the strength of the line. And that's kind of, I think, not even just a strength, but maybe the best interior trio in the entire league.
Yeah.
If you're just looking across, you know, the entire league at their three guys in the interior, it's as good as it gets. So I would not want to mess with that and mess with that cohesion. But when we'll see if he's out there. He's been out there a little bit in some of these OTA practices, but there's obviously no contact, so everything's kind of light, and it's more just kind of mental reps more than anything, I think. He hasn't really done anything with pads on, or he hasn't really hit anybody yet since that Achilles injury, so we'll see what happens. But I really like the fact that they have two young guys. It's kind of scary, right? They don't have that veteran. They don't have a Trent Brown right now in camp that can kind of, you know, be that veteran just in case type guy that emerges. But they do have Kajus and they do have Wynn, who are very talented young players who can really play, I think, both left or right tackle too. Like,
yes.
Marcus Cannon's not getting any younger. And one of these two guys, I think, could easily be the replacement for him down the road also. So so it looks, the future looks bright at the tackle position. We'll see how it looks now. right this second with left tackle is kind of up in the air. And in front.
Like, I want to see.
The next one here, we got.
Hello?
Adam's cutting in and out. Let's see if we get him back. You there?
Yeah, can you hear me now? Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. I got
just,
you.
Just one last thing on Yadney. You touched on it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I want to see him, like, well, I mean, the other thing about his play at West Virginia, he's never really in a three-point stance, right?
I know.
You know, so, I mean, there's going to be a lot of, you know, eye formation with the Pats, so you need to see him sort of develop that skill set. And I don't even know how much he did that even in high school. So, you know, that's why I want to see the reps, you know what I mean? Because it's like you said, his offense at West Virginia wasn't really anything like you'd see at the Pats. It's just so much more complex. So, so that's my little point
there. Yeah, great point. It's kind of interesting though that he was able to play with such great leverage in the run game, even with a 2-point stance. So that does bode well for him in terms of that transition. But yeah, it seems like there's a lot of transition with him, right? You know, he's going to be in a whole new offense that's going to ask a whole lot more of him in terms of pass sets and run blocking, and ask him to, you know, line up in a 3-point stance and ask him to kick more further out and do all sorts of different things. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. All right, moving on now to the quarterback room. Obviously, we know who's at top. That's no questions asked there. But the number two job, I think, is going to be one of the more interesting kind of battles in camp as well. Some of these other kind of getting into the weeds of the tight ends and the corners and the offensive linemen like we do, I think a lot of people's eyes are going to be on Jarrett Stidham, honestly, and kind of just what he's made of and what he brings to the table. I think a lot of people would like to see them elevate the backup quarterback position if they can, but it was just one practice. I don't want to overreact too much to one practice. He looked like a guy that has a long way to go before he's beating out Brian Hoyer last week. But do you think that he can do it? I mean, there's always a chance. I mean, obviously we can hedge that with this. There's always a chance that he can do it. But, I mean, do you see it happening in terms of him winning the backup job and potentially pushing Brian Hoyer off the roster?
Well, I think when you draft a guy, any guy I think you'd want to see that, but I don't think you're going to.
Yeah.
I just think it's too big of a leap given the – where he came from college-wise to where he's coming now, not competition level-wise. He played in the SEC, but just in terms of what he's learning and what he did from high school to college to here, it's so different. It just feels like you know, going from a freshman in high school to a senior in college, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of like the learning process, because, you know, even when he was at Baylor and then when he was at Auburn, you know, it was, I didn't see too many like multiple progressions with accuracy. You know yeah. what I mean? I felt like, you know, just like we said, you know, when we broke down the draft a little bit, the accuracy is there when, you know, when the first read is there and it's open, but, you know, from down to down, play to play consistency, I didn't see it. He did protect the ball pretty well, but I don't think, you know, in the NFL right away in the preseason, he's going to be somebody that lights it up. I just don't think you're going to see that. And I don't think you should really expect that yet. You know, at least Hoyer at this point, you know, he's not, you know, Hoyer's not going to win you the Super Bowl or anything like that, but he knows the system in and out,
yeah.
you know? So if Brady did go down, knock on wood, you know, like you'd want a guy who at least can speak the language a little bit better, and you don't really want Stidham there yet. I think it's too big of a hill to climb for him at this point.
Yeah. So there is precedent, right? Like they've done it before with a rookie as the backup. They did it with Jimmy G and they did it with Ryan Mallett. Both of those guys are, you know, won the backup job. Now, obviously Jimmy G was the highest quarterback that Bill Belichick's ever drafted as Patriots head coach. So that kind of tells you why he won the backup job a little bit. But Stidham, you know, is a fourth round pick, is a pretty high draft pick. This guy's going to be on the roster. It's really just a question of is he going to be the backup or are they going to carry three quarterbacks? I think the biggest thing that we saw in practice last week was just that the game is really fast for him right now. Yeah. And even like you can tell that the gears are turning and his processing speed and his thinking is just not there. And he's almost thinking too much, right? Like
right.
he wants to make sure that he's getting the play right. And he's thinking a whole lot. I mean, I'm trying not to like trash on him, but he threw an interception during a walkthrough last week. You know, like they were doing a walkthrough going half speed and he threw a pass directly to Daron Harmon. And the rest of the defense kind of just was like, how could you throw an interception in a walkthrough? Like,
yeah.
this is ridiculous. Like, what are you doing? And he just was, you could tell that he's thinking so much right now. The game is moving fast for him and he's just trying to get a grasp on this complex offense. Like a lot of the rookies are. So I think that that's, you know, a big element of it. It's not, you know, I think there's going to be some growing pains like that with N'Keal Harry, but N'Keal Harry is playing receiver, you know? So at the end of the day, he just needs to know which route to run. He doesn't need to know what everybody else is running, you know, right. at least not right away. So that I think is a big element of it for Stidham. I also think that, you know, and this is why I've kind of been banging the table for Brian Hoyer to stick around, is there's a very underrated aspect of what Brian Hoyer does in preparation every single week for games. In terms of game planning, both helping Brady out, watching film and studying up on opponents. Brady last year actually got to the point where he was giving certain assignments to Brian Hoyer, you know, watch all their red zone defense, watch all of their, you know, this kind of, that kind of situational stuff. And then Brian Hoyer would kind of educate him on all of it at one point in the week. And they kind of go over it together. They have a great relationship, those two. Probably a lot to do with the fact that Brady doesn't feel threatened by him, but at the same time, it's still a great relationship. He also is a phenomenal scout team quarterback from all, you know, from everything that we've heard. And all the defensive players after the Super Bowl last year just gave him tons and tons of credit for simulating all of the quarterbacks that they faced, but especially Jared Goff. But we're talking about simulating Philip Rivers, Patrick Mahomes, and Jared Goff. That's a pretty good, you know, trio of quarterbacks, especially the MVP of the league and Philip Rivers. And he kind of got that defense ready to face all of those guys. And the defense was singing his praises after the Super Bowl at how good of a job he did with kind of the communication, simulating that communication between Goff and Sean McVay with the headset and all that kind of stuff. And that's an underrated element of this whole thing too. So what you're losing, I think, with him is a very bright football mind who in a lot of ways probably isn't quite the encyclopedia that Tom Brady is, but it's kind of like a, you know, Tom Brady light in terms of his football IQ. Obviously doesn't have the physical gifts that Tom Brady does, but he has that kind of brain and kind of processing as well. So there's a lot to be said about that. And I think in this kind of situation with the backup role, you're kind of, you don't have the next guy, right? You didn't draft the guy in the first or second round right away. And you're kind of hoping that Stidham is going to be the guy that you develop into maybe potentially being that guy 2 to 3 years down the road. So let him develop and don't give him kind of all this pressure of being the backup to Brady, you know, and kind of give him time to grow into himself and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, right now, if Brady goes down, like, they're probably not in great shape anyways. Like, there's probably nothing that they're going to do. So I would kind of err on the side of caution of putting Stidham as the backup quarterback. But at the same time, we'll see what happens, you know, in minicamp and training camp, see kind of the strides that he makes. But right now, based off of what I've seen of him in training camp and also even last year in college, where he was one of the least accurate quarterbacks in this draft class by pretty much everybody that, you know, studied the QBs and really studied ball placement, PFF, and any of the other guys that do that kind of stuff ahead of the draft, he was had one of the worst accuracy statistics out of all of them. And especially during, you know, under pressure, it was pretty putrid last year.
Yeah.
Like, at the same time, it was a much different offense, like you said. So.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, anybody that watched Auburn is such a funky offense that, like,
it really is.
Like, a lot of the, like, completion percentage stats are because, you know, they'll, like, getting ready to play the Auburn offense as a defense, you'll lose stuff, you know, because it's, you know, you'll guys will be wide open. And so that's a lot of, and there's a lot of predetermined stuff that just is there, you know? And so a lot of his stats come off that. I think with Stidham, he just, it's one of those things where he just doesn't know what he doesn't know yet. You know, he's just opening the book for the first time, and it's going to take some time. I think, you know, there's obviously some physical tools there that they like. I don't think he's never going to develop into anything. But like you said, the accuracy issues. But like you said, there's just something to be said for a veteran backup who knows the offense, who's got a close relationship with Brady, you know, and, you know, has been working with the team before. So and has played in big games and been a starter before.
Yeah,
you know,
people forget that he was almost the starter in Cleveland until, you know, he was the starter, but he was almost like kind of an answer for them until he tore his ACL.
Right, you know? Right. So, I mean, you know, the guy's played in the league for a long time. You know, he's been around. You know, and that's the exact opposite of Jarrett. So, you know, I think if you know, you don't necessarily want Jarrett to be the backup right away. It'll take some time.
Yeah, I mean, he throws a pretty ball. Stidham does, as we've all kind of said. And he has control of the football. He's not necessarily the most accurate guy, but he certainly can kind of throw the ball around defenders and do that whole thing. He knows where the ball is going most of the time. I just think that, you know, the actual precise ball placement, like when I was watching him, it's kind of funny. Like he leads the QB class this year and throws that went off his receiver's hands or were not caught because of drops or were caught that weren't actually accurate.
like
behind the receiver or over his head or underthrown, but the receiver is still in the area, you know? Yeah. And I think that that's something that you kind of have to, you know, trust your eyes on and really kind of study to see that, okay, like this ball was completed, but it wasn't actually thrown where it was meant to be thrown, or this was a drop because of this. And that's kind of, you know, a thing with Stidham, I think, as well as, you know, his accuracy is in the ballpark, but it's often just like a little bit off. Yes. And that, you know, kind of is the worrisome thing about him. Quickly before we move on, what are they going to do with Danny Etling? And is there a role for Danny Etling?
No, I think he's still a practice squad guy.
Yeah.
And like you've mentioned before, I mean, he's he's done some good scouting things before. So I don't know. I think, you know, since they drafted Stidham, I don't think they're, you know, he's going to be one of the top three guys. So, you know, I don't even know how many reps you'll see of him in the preseason. He won't be, you know, playing a lot.
I would be surprised if we see him throw more than a couple of passes next week, honestly.
Right. So, I don't know. I think he's safe on the practice squad. I don't think anybody can, you know, yank him unless there's tons of injuries, but
yeah, that's a good point. He's definitely not somebody that I think other teams are like dying to pick up. you know, unless he really, really shows something in the preseason that kind of is surprising. And I don't mean like a 70-yard touchdown run with nobody around him. I mean, like, actually something, then maybe that could change. But right now, I don't think anybody is kind of hoping the Patriots cut Danny Etling so they can
Right. I mean, I don't mean this is a huge knock or anything. I was shocked that he got drafted at all.
I think everybody was.
You know? But, so.
Yeah, I actually was talking to one of the guys at PFF at the Combine who said that, you know, the Patriots use some of their data for the draft, and they, you know, they put in requests, right? They put in a request to a certain player, like, give us all of Jared Stidham's throws, or, you know, accuracy, what you guys graded them out as, whatever the case may be. And apparently they did a ton of homework on Danny Etling. And they were like one of the few teams that actually said anything to them about Danny Etling in the lead up to the draft. And they really liked the guy. And you know, it showed, obviously, they drafted him. So we'll see what happens. But I think everybody was kind of taken by surprise that he got drafted. And there were some quarterbacks this year and last year that didn't get drafted that I think people liked way more than Danny Etling. Like a Brett Rypien, for example, didn't get drafted.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that everybody that watched those two guys in college would say that Rypien was a much better player than Danny Etling was. So it's one of those weird things that there was just something about him, something that they heard, something that they liked. Let's ask this last one here. Obviously, we got to talk about the punter battle. We got to do it. And this is going to be, I think, another kind of big storyline. I think some people are going to kind of think it's tongue-in-cheek and laugh about it. But from everything that we have heard, everything that we saw of Jake Bailey last week, the kid from Stanford has a boot. I mean, he can really punt the ball. There is some talk about him being a little bit inconsistent. Sometimes the ball doesn't come off his foot exactly the way that you want it to. Ryan Allen is kind of the opposite. He's got like an above average but nothing special leg, but every single time he punts the ball, it seems to work out. You know what I mean? Like, he's not the type of guy that has too many shanks. So, not to get too much in the weeds, I don't think either one of us is exactly a kicking, punting expert, but is Ryan Allen in big trouble here? I mean, this is a guy that could have probably, if in a different day and age, you might be voting for him for Super Bowl MVP last year.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably as deserving as anybody for it.
Wasn't yeah. You know, I mean, he has had a hell of a game. He might have out-punted Johnny Hecker.
Yeah, I know. And it's not like, I mean, he's always been a good punter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's a solid guy. Like, I sort of, you know, what the fact that they drafted Bailey at all tells me how much they like Bailey more than I think it says more about that than what it says about Allen. I mean, and you know, when we were doing our position battles, I was probably going to do the punter. I just wanted to sort of mix it up a little bit, but punter is probably the one where it's actually going to be like, I don't know, maybe the most competitive because you got like really two. I mean, Allen's a very good player. Like,
Allen's going to punt somewhere in the league next year.
Yeah.
If he gets cut, then he's going to be a starting punter elsewhere.
Yeah, he's really good. So, I mean, I think if they felt strongly enough about Bailey and from all the reports that Bailey's got this massive leg and accurate too, in terms of where he wants to put it, then I wouldn't be shocked at all if he makes the team. So if I'm Allen, you know, I don't know. I think Bailey probably makes the team. It's crazy to me though, because Allen really is a good player. But yeah, I mean, I think Allen's got to be worried.
Yeah, I mean, so the guys at Stanford, I think one of the Athletic guys wrote about this. I don't know if it was Nick Underhill or Jeff, but one of those guys that wrote on this. The guys at Stanford, the nerds over there, developed a stat that is kind of trying to quantitate what punters bring to the table, right? And it's not, it takes into account not only punting, but also like kickoffs, holding, how athletic they are for fakes, like that, all that kind of stuff. And Jake Bailey is like off the charts in this stat, like one of the best they've ever graded. And then the guys at PFF, who have kind of actually brought in former NFL punters to grade punters for them. They did the same thing with kickers. He was like the highest graded punter. Him and the guy from Utah that got drafted were like the highest graded punter they have in their system. And you can also like kind of correlate these stats to what they would then do in the NFL if they were NFL punters. And the Stanford Stanford stat says that Jake Bailey would have been one of the best punters in the NFL last year if he was in the NFL. So this guy is, like, for lack of a better word, is like a punting prodigy. Like, he's like as good as it gets for a punting prospect that we've seen in a long time. That's why the Patriots drafted him. He is athletic. He ran like a 4.7 in the 40 at the combine. So if you want to run any sort of fakes with him, I mean, he's, as Bill Belichick would say about Johnny Hecker, he is a weapon. Like, he is an absolute weapon. He punts the crap out of the ball. I mean, when I tell you, Adam, the punts were so high. Like, they were so high. Like, there had to – it was, like, it was a cloudy day, and it, like, felt like they were touching, like, the lower half of the clouds. And they were long. He was doing this drill with Matthew Slater. Slater, which is really cool, kind of just, like, hangs out with the special teamers and, like, does his thing at practice. He doesn't even, like, go with the rest of the team. Like, if they're, like – he doesn't run routes. He doesn't do anything else. He just does special teams all the time. He does this drill – that he's like essentially the gunner. They put a guy next to him to block him, and he just kind of simulates him being a gunner in a game. Jake Bailey landed a punt inside the one 3 times in a row.
Oh my God.
And Slater just like caught it like over his shoulder, like it was a pass 3 times in a row. And that's Slater just like kind of looked at the Cam Accord, the assistant special teams coach, and was just like, holy shit. like this guy is incredible. And everybody was just kind of, all the reporters down there, everyone was just like, what the hell? Like, how is this guy that good? There were, I think, and not to like get too nerdy about it, but there were a few shanks. You know, like there were a few punts that didn't come off the foot too pretty. There were also a few kickoffs. He was booming kickoffs too, for the most part. There were a few. Now, we don't know. He could have been doing that on purpose on some of these. Like, he could have been practicing squib kicks for all we know. Yeah. You know what I mean? I have no idea. But he was, there was one, and you know, like how there's like the fence behind the practice fields? He hit it over the fence. Oh my like, goodness. It had to have been like 85 yards in the air or something like that on the kickoff. So this guy can really kick the freaking ball. And that just kind of tells you everything you need to know. But at the same time, Ryan Allen is just so consistent. Like, he's been so solid for them. He and Matthew Slater also, like, really developed a rapport with pinning teams deep. And it was, you know, apparent in the Super Bowl. They did that a bunch last year, pinning teams inside the 10 or even inside the 5-yard line at times, where Slater just would run to a landmark and the ball could just perfectly land right where he was, that kind of stuff. You know, Slater said last year that Allen, like, makes it easy for him on most of those plays because the ball really just lands exactly where he wants it to go. But at the same time, I mean, it's hard to deny what we saw and what all these people are saying that are kind of more punting experts than you or me about how good Jake Bailey is. And, you know, I just think that there's something to be said, though, for the consistency of Ryan Allen and the reliability. Like, you just know what you're getting with him, and you know that he's not going to do anything to lose you a game, you know. And but at the same time, with Bailey, he also can do – he can be a kickoff specialist, which kind of takes away some of the workload for Gostkowski as well, which I think is something that they would like to do. Gostkowski said that he likes to kick off because it gets him on the field, but he also admitted that it kind of wears down his leg by the end of the season, all those kickoffs. So I think that that's a big part of it. But man, I mean, what a leg this kid has in terms of just watching him in practice. Like, he might've been the best player on the field. And that's like not a knock on everybody else that was on the field. Like, that was just, like, how it felt. Now, Brady will be there next week, so I think that will probably go away. But it was incredible to watch. He put on a clinic. He put on an absolute clinic. But
I think the bottom line is if you can upgrade a position, you upgrade it no matter how good the other person is.
Yeah.
And if they can upgrade it a punter, then go ahead, you know.
I also would not put it past Bill Belichick to pull off a trade at punter.
Like, if, I know they could.
Like, if Jake Bailey wins the job, like, I wouldn't just like think it's immediate that they're going to cut Ryan Allen. Like, I would think that they would try to shop him first.
They like, can.
Yeah.
He's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can get something for him.
I think that people, you know, in New England, not to like go all, you know, straw man, but I think that people in New England don't realize like how lucky we've had it with specialists in terms of just kickers and punters.
Oh my God.
The Patriots have never had a problem there in the Belichick era. They've gone right from Vinatieri to Gostkowski. They did have like that slight problem when Gostkowski got hurt that one year, but like that doesn't count. And they've never had a problem at punter really either. And all these other teams around the league, at one point or another, one of those positions probably screwed them badly in a game. You know, whether it was a shank punt or a missed kick in a crucial situation late in a game or overtime or something like that, they've all kind of lost games as a result of one of their kickers, it seems like, except the Patriots. So I think that the Patriots have it really good at those positions, and I think that Belichick, more than anything, just wants to not have to think about it, right? Like, you know, you don't want to have to, like, call the kicker back because you're too worried that he's not going to make the kick, or have to go for it on fourth down because your punter is crap. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you don't want those things. And the Patriots, hey, a trade up punter. I also wouldn't, like, say it's 0% chance that they keep two punters. Like, would you put it past Bill Belichick to do that? Because I wouldn't.
No, right? I mean, he's so much values that part of the game in terms of special teams, rightly so. I think we've seen over the years. So who knows, you know?
Yeah, like I think that's like a 1% chance of happening, but I would never say it's zero, you know? Like I wouldn't say it's zero that he would do that. And that would be, I think that would really, if they cut like a guy that people like and keep two punters,
yeah.
I could not wait for the reaction.
That would be hilarious.
All right, we've talked about punters for like 10 minutes at this point. And people better get used to it, because we're obviously going to talk about that position battle all throughout the summer. So it's going to be one of the ones at the top of the list. Is there anything you want to plug? This is that portion of the show.
Yeah, on Sunday, BC is having the first session of camp where, you know, high school players are coming in to sort of impress the staff and earn an offer. So I'm going to see what local kids come in and, you know, maybe – you know, show the staff a little something. So, nice. You know, BC is putting together a nice little class so far, and yeah, it's definitely with the Fish Field House and their facilities upgrade, they're getting a really good caliber of athlete, not just on campus, but committing to the school. So we'll see what local players maybe earn an offer this weekend.
Massachusetts football, man. I mean, I know we keep on saying it, like, you know, we're trying to like overhype BC, UMass, those programs, but I think that people kind of realized last year with BC, especially how many guys got drafted out of BC in the draft. And obviously, you know, guys like Andy Isabella out of UMass are kind of making big names and big waves. So those teams that are not, you know, go watch those teams this fall.
Yeah,
they're going to be solid football teams and give you something to do on a Saturday. So go check that out on clnsmedia.com. We got a piece about Juwan Williams up right now, comparing him to Brennan Browner and how the Patriots used Browner in 2014, trying to kind of project the role that they have in mind for Williams as kind of that big bodied corner, cover maybe some tight ends, play in the slot a little bit against bigger slot receivers, that kind of stuff. Go also coming tomorrow on Friday, or we'll already be up on Friday if you're listening to this after tomorrow. I'm going to start doing a series of posts kind of breaking down the Patriots' go-to passing plays. So kind of looking at some of their go-to plays. They don't have tons of tendencies, but they certainly run a lot of the same plays every single week. So kind of trying to shed some light on what some of those are. Tomorrow we're going to start off with a bang with one of my favorites, which is the fake wide receiver screen, which I think is one of their best plays, honestly. Play designs. They get teams to bite on that thing weekly. And it's great. One of the main plays that I used was Josh Gordon 55-yarder against Green Bay last year. And you know, you fake the bubble screen, the guy's all outside release, and they kind of act like they're blocking for that half a second, and the whole secondary just comes like screaming up to play the screen, and then they just slip one of those guys behind the defense, and it's like a big play almost every single time they run it. And they run it with such precision and such execution. You know, I think that one of the things about, not to go on too much of a rant here, but one of the things that a lot of people kind of have been talking about around the league is marrying all of your concepts together so everything looks similar. This is something that Sean McVay talks a lot about, Kyle Shanahan, Josh McDaniels. They all talk about how – there's kind of like a basis of five or six plays that everything kind of branches out off of. And the key is to make it all look the same to get defenses to react in certain ways. And I think the Patriots do a great job of that. And the fake wide receiver screen is a great example. Everybody knows that they love to throw those kind of bubble screens to Edelman and stuff like that. So every once in a while, they just fake one of them and they, mm-hmm. you know, get explosive plays out of it. So that'll be up there. We'll also obviously have you covered wall to wall. And next week at minicamp, we'll be down there all 3 days doing videos, doing posts. I'll have a notebook every single day with kind of my observations. And before we sign off, I also want to plug the CLNS Bruins coverage, obviously, for the Stanley Cup. Didn't go too well last night, Adam, but hopefully they'll turn it around for the rest of the series. Sierra Goodwell is in St. Louis. She's got coverage there for games 3 and 4. Trags will be joining her in St. Louis for game 6. Obviously, everybody will be on hand for game 5 here in Boston. But they're doing such a great job over at Bruins. Obviously, both of us know what it's like to go through a playoff run. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of long nights. And yeah. they're killing it. So go check those guys out there on our YouTube, CLNS Media YouTube page. They're all on the over the website, social media. I believe it's at Bruins CLNS, just like our at Patriots CLNS handle. So go check those guys out and go Bruins. I mean, you know,
I think they're going to win the series, man.
Are you still confident?
Yeah, I'm still confident. I got to admit, I'm more of a basketball guy, but like, there's just something that seems like that. I feel like there's just something special about this team from the watching them play as little as I have. And you know, from the people who do follow it closely, what they tell me, I just feel like, you know, this is going to be a really tough series. And, you know, obviously it's very competitive. I think most of the games, I think the games that you've seen the first two are going to typify what the entire series is like. I think it's going to go 7, but that's going to be back in Boston. And I think they're going to win.
All right. I like that take. I think that the only kind of fear out of last night that I kind of had was that it looked to me like the Blues were really taking it to them physically. Mm. And that starts to wear on you as the series kind of goes on. And that's what happened to the teams earlier in the playoffs that the Blues played, especially the Sharks. The Sharks at the beginning of that series looked like the better team. And then all of a sudden, like around game 5, just the heaviness of the Blues, the constant pressure that they put on the Sharks kind of started to weigh on them. The Sharks got banged up in that series too because of all the physicality. They're a heavy team, the Blues. But we knew that coming in. And I think that people that, you know, everybody kind of got really excited after game 1. The Bruins have won like 8 straight playoff games at that point, and everybody was like, they're never going to lose again. You know, that was kind of like the mindset. And then they get slapped in the face in game 2. But I still agree. I think that they're going to pull it out. I think that so many of these playoff series, we don't get this in football, but in these other sports, so much of it is like adjustments, right?
Yes.
It's like a heavyweight fight. Like the Bruins did one thing in game 1 that worked, and the Blues came back and kind of adjusted and did the next thing in game 2. So now who, you know, kind of wins the adjustments in game 3? That's the way it goes.
Are you saying the Blues run the power eye?
Yeah.
They just sort of lean on you for 4 quarters.
Blues might be like a wing tee, honestly. they're an old – they don't have – like Tarasenko is a really – like he's a really skilled player, but they don't have a ton of skilled players. Like they're not like one of those teams like Toronto or one of those teams that like really skates up and down the ice and has like a ton of skill and a ton of offensive firepower. They're like an old school hockey team. They're like, you know, we're going to forecheck and we're going to play good defense and we have a good goalie that we lean on, and that's the whole thing. And that can wear on any team, even a team as good as the Bruins. But go Bruins. Follow everybody on Bruins CLNS. They're doing great work. Adam and I will be back next week. We'll do some mini camp recap type stuff and look at, you know, what kind of went on those 3 days. But until next time, signing off for Adam Kirchen, I'm Evan Lazar. Thanks for listening.